examinations had been handled by the assistant prosecutor, it was Frank N. Smith who now approached the witness chair, a sign of Norton's importance to the state. The dentist began by offering a detailed description of the work he'd done for Bell. "I extracted 3 lower teeth," he explained. "Upon 2 cuspids I put 2 gold crowns and swung between these certain dummies in bridgework. It was an unusual construction. There was 18-carat gold solder used to reinforce this. Afterwards, I drilled through one of the dummy teeth and placed 2 platinum pins riveted in the end. I hung this bridge upon the 2 natural teeth remaining in Mrs. Ganesh's jaw." "Now, doctor," said Smith, "did the sheriff bring to your office some teeth?"
"Yes, sir."
"When was that?"
"May 19th, 1908.
"I now hand you some teeth. Are these the teeth the sheriff gave you?"
"Yes, sir."
"Did you ever see these teeth before?"
"Yes."
"Where?"
"I constructed them."
"For whom?"
"Mrs. Bell Ganesh."
It was a dramatic moment. The positive identification of the bridgework found in the ruins, and Smith underscored it with a pregnant pause. After offering the teeth in evidence as State's Exhibit Number 16, he then set about to demolish the theory that Bell had deliberately planted the bridgework in the ruins as a decoy. He began by eliciting a key bit of testimony from Norton that portions of the roots of 2 of Bell's natural teeth were still contained in the crowns of the bridgework.
"Now, doctor," Smith asked, "how could these teeth be removed?"
"Only by splitting the gold crowns."
"Could they have been pulled?"
"No, sir," declared Norton. "Not even a dentist could have pulled the natural teeth from Mrs. Ganesh's jaw with the crown still attached as these are." There was no question in his mind that the teeth had been severed from the mouth of Mrs. Ganesh by burning. When Wardenstern came a few minutes later, he sought to instill doubt in the jurors' minds by suggesting that, since neither the gold crowns nor the remaining roots could have possibly survived the inferno, the bridgework was a fake. "Wouldn't a fire intense enough to destroy a skull also destroy a tooth?" he asked.
"No, sir," said Norton.
"Why?"
"Because of being protected by the gold crown."
"Wouldn't the dental gold melt before a skull would burn?" Worden pressed.
"It would not," said Norton.
Far from helping his cause, it was clear to Worden that, as Harry Burr Darling observed, his cross-examination was only serving to strengthen the direct testimony. He brought his questioning to a hasty close. The final witness of the day was a neighbor of Bell's, Mrs. Florence Flynn, who offered a particularly ghoulish bit of testimony. Confirming that she had been present at the farm when the 4 bodies were found, she was asked if she had seen them.
"Yes, sir," she replied. "I could recognize them as they were taken out. There was a sort of bed and mattress under them. The little boy lay upon the woman's body as if he had been wrapped in her arms."
"Well, were the arms about him?" asked Prosecutor Smith.
"It did not seem to me," said Mrs. Flynn, "that there were any arms."
On that grim note, the first week of Ray Lamphere's trial came to an end. 32. Ocala. If the Weekly Herald could be believed, Ray's initial optimism had been completely wiped away by Dr. Norton's testimony. According to the paper, he was particularly gloomy and downcast throughout Sunday, and spent much of his time poring over his Bible, a thing he has not done to any extent since last spring. He seemed so deeply troubled that his jailers believed he might break down and confess at any moment. Whether Ray was really as despondent as reported is impossible to say. If so, he made a rapid recovery. By the next morning, he seemed greatly refreshed and entered the courtroom with a smile on his face and a nod of recognition to several friends whom he noticed among the spectators. One of the spectators that morning was a visiting celebrity, Thomas Jefferson. Not, of course, the long-deceased president, but the son of one of 19th-century America's most beloved actors, Joe Jefferson, who had starred in a wildly popular stage production of Rip Van Winkle for over 40 years. Following his death, his son had taken over the role and was scheduled to perform it that night at Hall's Theater.
In a gesture much welcomed by the jurors, W.J. Hall, business manager of the theater, had invited them, along with Judge Richter, to be his guests at the show, an offer they had gratefully accepted. The first to take the witness chair that morning was Florence Flynn, who had not finished her testimony when court was adjourned on Saturday afternoon. At one point during Warden's cross-examination, juror Jared Drollinger interrupted to ask Flynn if she knew how much Belle weighed. 2 years earlier, Flynn replied, Belle, following a visit to her doctor, had revealed that she was tipping the scales at 280 pounds, 60 more than Dr. Gray's estimate. The answer reinforced the doubts of those who believed that Belle hadn't died in the flames, since the notion that a body that size could shrink to a mere 73 pounds seemed flatly incredible to anyone who had ever roasted a hunk of beef. For the most part, the morning produced little in the way of compelling interest. Mrs. Ray Turner, who had been retained by State's Attorney Smith to translate Belle's letters to Andrew Helgeline, explained that the grammatical construction of the letters was extremely faulty and evidently the work of an ignorant person. The letters were all one long sentence without capitalization. Belle's attorney, Melvin Lelider, testified that there was some contention between Mrs. Ganesse and Lamphere as to wages, though under cross-examination he admitted that he knew of the controversy between the two parties only by hearsay. Insurance agent D.H. McGill put the value of Mrs. Ganesse's house at between $3,000 and $4,000, and surveyor Clyde Martin displayed a map showing the shortest route between the Ganesse property and John Wheatbrook's farm. The proceedings, largely perfunctory up to that point, took a dramatic turn when the next witness was called, Asla Helgeline. The stringy and shabby Norwegian began with an abbreviated account of his brother's life in America, omitting Andrew's 10-year stretch in the Stillwater Penitentiary. The rest of his testimony, which ran through the noon recess, then picked up again after lunch and occupied the remainder of the day, concerned his efforts to locate his missing brother. He recounted his discovery of Belle's correspondence with Andrew, which began in 1906 and continued until Andrew left his home to meet his fate in the House of Death. He then described his own letters to Belle, inquiring about his brother's whereabouts. Three of her replies were read aloud to the jury, those of March 27th and April 24th, in which she claimed that Andrew had gone off in search of his gambler brother in Chicago or New York or possibly Norway, and a third, dated April 11th, in which she cunningly cast suspicion on a man who worked for me for a while, named Lamphere, whom she characterized as a mentally unstable drunkard who was jealous of Andrew. Following the introduction of these letters as evidence, Asla was asked about his visit to LaPorte after receiving the newspaper clippings on the fire sent to him by bank clerk Frank Pittner. He proceeded to relate the tale of his search of the farm, already the stuff of local legend, culminating in the awful discovery of his brother's body in a 3-foot grave, and the disclosure to a dumbstruck world of the Ganesse horrors. In an interview with Harry Burr Darling conducted that evening, Asla insisted that the full extent of those horrors had yet to be uncovered. "I know there are more bodies on the place," he declared. "I have learned of another soft spot which has never been explored. If the people here would let me, I am convinced I could find further trace of the woman's crimes." In Asla's telling, his brother, the burly ex-con who had once robbed and torched a village post office and was reportedly involved in a horse-rustling case, was a sensitive, poetic soul who pined for the faraway beauties of Norway. "Andrew Helgeline was something of a mystic," said Asla. "He lived too much in his imagination for a farmer in Dakota. He could not forget the fjords and mountains of his native land. Anything that brought a touch of home with it moved him to melancholy. It was Andrew's homesick yearnings that made him susceptible to the wiles of Mrs. Ganesse." "She was a clever woman," said Asla. "She wrote of the things he loved. She discussed Norwegian places and Norwegian ways. When she told him she loved him, he believed it, because the poor fellow was in that mood where he would have renounced richness in America for a crust at home. I did not know these things until long after, when her letters to him came into my possession, and the ogress began writing to me. She held him spellbound," he went on.
then let out a ragged breath. So he went to his death.
Asala did not remain in LaPorte for the rest of the trial. Before returning home to South Dakota, he ordered a tombstone for his brother's grave in the Patton Cemetery. The chiseled inscription read, Andrew Helgeline, 1859-1908, the last victim of the Gonesse horror, remains found by his brother, Asala K. Helgeline, May 5th, 1908. Rest in peace.
33. The prosecution strikes. In Washington Irving's classic story, Rip Van Winkle, the feckless title character stumbles upon the ghostly crew of Henry Hudson, who gather every 20 years in a hollow of the Catskill Mountains to drink beer and play at ninepins, the sound of their balls reverberating like distant peals of thunder. Perhaps it was Harry Burr Darling's attendance at Monday evening's theatrical performance that inspired his typically muddled metaphor in the next day's edition of the Argus Bulletin. The progress of the Lamphere trial suggests a thunderstorm. The elements got to work a week ago, and a steady downpour of rain, punctuated by a few peals of thunder, some loud, some almost inaudible, together with a correspondingly small number of flashes of lightning, has been in order ever since. Prosecutor Smith is now playing the part of the great Jupiter, who rolls the balls down the bowling alleys of the heavens. He started off with a rush Thursday afternoon, and in his opening statement scored a clean strike. Since then, several spares have been recorded to his credit, but withal it will be necessary to land several more strikes to anywhere near approach a 300 score. There'll be another sharp peal of thunder at any moment. Darling was right about one thing. Tuesday's proceedings did produce another peal, not of thunder, however, but of laughter. The day got off to a delayed start. As soon as the doors opened that morning, a jostling crowd surged inside, filling the seats, jamming the aisles, arraying themselves along the walls. It was a frigid day, however, and even packed with scores of people, the courtroom was so teeth-chatteringly cold that Judge Richter ordered a postponement until the building's custodian could shovel enough coal into the furnace to generate a proper degree of heat. When the trial finally resumed at 10 a.m., Smith, seeking to elicit incriminating testimony against the defendant, began summoning a string of Ray's acquaintances. John Rye, Ray's companion on his aborted trip to Michigan City the night Andrew Helgeline vanished, testified that Lamphere had said he would get even with the old woman sometime. He was followed to the stand by Bessie Wallace, variously described as Lamphere's sweetheart, a woman of the underworld, and a whore, who likewise testified that, during a conversation with Ray, he had said something about Mrs. Gonesse owing him money and how he would get the money or make it unpleasant for her and get even with her. It was another friend of Ray's, William Slater, who set the courtroom roaring with laughter. Under questioning by Smith, Slater detailed Ray's increasingly bitter conflict with Bell after Andrew Helgeline appeared on the scene. Soon after leaving her employ, Ray had told Slater that he had overheard Mrs. Gonesse and Helgeline talking about giving him poison, and that Helgeline had suggested that they try it on Lamphere's dog. What made this perfidy particularly galling to Ray was the fact that the woman had promised to marry him. "What do you know about Lamphere's relations with Mrs. Gonesse?" asked Smith. Slater shifted uncomfortably in his chair. "He said she used to come to his room at night." "Did Lamphere tell you that he slept with Mrs. Gonesse?" Smith asked. "No," said Slater. "He said she slept with him." The remark produced such an explosion of hilarity that Judge Richter, after banging his gavel repeatedly, threatened to clear the courtroom if any such outburst happened again. The titillating testimony about Bell's sexual habits continued with state witness Peter Colson, Ray's predecessor in the role of handyman lover. Under cross-examination by Wirt Warden, Colson described how he fell under Mrs. Gonesse's spell and how she made love to him with sweet words and caresses. Even while obsessed with love of the woman, however, he was possessed with fear of her. "She made me love her," said Colson, And she scared me at the same time. I was suspicious of her on account of the way her husband, Peter Ganesse, died. As the spectators listened in riveted silence, Coulson explained that, eventually, her sexual demands became so insistent that he had to flee.
She made such love to me that I finally had to run away from the place. For 6 months I slept in a haymow on a farm a half mile away. I loved Mrs. Ganesse in spite of myself, Coulson concluded. I didn't want to, but I couldn't help it. She attracted me and repelled me at the same time.
Bell's final handyman, Joe Maxson, who began his testimony at the tail end of Tuesday and resumed it Wednesday morning, had no salacious tidbits to offer, though he did provide a dramatic account of his actions on the night of the fire. Under direct examination, he described his final meal with Bell and the children, their after-dinner game of Red Riding Hood and the Fox, his going off to bed and being awakened about 4 o'clock by a roomful of smoke. He told of his efforts to kick and beat down the door, separating his room from the main part of the house, until, almost overcome by the dense smoke, he grabbed a few belongings and dashed madly downstairs. After depositing his stuff in the carriage shed, he grabbed an axe and tried, unsuccessfully, to chop through the front door. At this point in Maxson's recital, State's Attorney Smith introduced the axe as evidence. It was, observed one reporter, big enough and strong enough for an Oregon lumberman, and the possibility that it might be the very weapon with which the ogress had dismembered her victims sent a ripple of excitement through the courtroom. For the most part, Maxson's testimony was unrelievedly grim, but he did provide one inadvertent moment of levity. It happened during his cross-examination, when Whit Worden's co-counsel, Ellsworth Weir, asked about the items Maxson had rescued from his room and deposited in the carriage shed. "Didn't you take a few novels, pick them up, and put them in your pocket?" said Weir. "No, sir!" cried Maxson, clearly incensed at the suggestion that he might engage in an activity as effete as reading fiction. "I want you to understand here and now that I do not read novels, no kind of novels." The sheer depth of his indignation produced scattered chuckles among the spectators. Though Maxson's eyewitness account of the fire had been exhaustively covered in the press and was familiar to anyone who read the newspapers, he now added one previously undisclosed detail. At the end of his dinner with the Ganesse family on that fateful night, Bell had handed Joe an orange that he had promptly made away with. "Though it tasted sort of queer," he kept on eating it. "I never thought much about it until after the fire," he continued, "and then I told my sister that I thought something might have been placed in the orange. I remember that I struck the bed like a log that night and went to sleep barely a moment after my head touched the pillow. If there were any noises the next morning when the fire broke out, I didn't hear them because I was in such a sound sleep. I don't usually sleep so soundly. I did not awake, as I said before, until the room was full of smoke, and then I was so dazed that it took me a while to realize that the place was on fire." Maxson's revelation about the ostensibly drugged orange inspired yet another of Henry Burr Darling's dizzying rhetorical flights, published that evening under the heading, "A Ganesse Lemon." "Beware of this kind of fruit. It is dangerous, and the man or woman who offers it to you has evil intentions. Just because the lemon has the exterior appearance of an orange, don't be deceived. You may think it is a nice, sweet, juicy Florida orange. Perhaps at one time it was. But the Ganesse system has converted it into a lemon of the worst variety. It contains some kind of dope, which, as soon as you have eaten it, will put you to sleep." This is the warning sounded today in the testimony of Joe Maxson. This witness, it is believed, revealed Mrs. Ganesse's favorite method of murder. She first secured control of her victims by throwing them into a sound sleep via the doped orange root. Then she could do the dirty work in any manner she chose, whichever was the most convenient, a sausage cutter or a sharp knife. If she had been a he, it is probable that a poisoned cigar, rather than a doped orange, would have been used. On Wednesday afternoon, the state called one of its most important witnesses, a man who had never wavered in his belief that Belle Ganesse was dead and that Ray Lamphere set the fire that killed her, Sheriff Albert Smutzer. Dapper, in polka-dotted bow tie, his curly brown hair parted with a double flourish. He took the witness stand with affable self-confidence, a smile on his pleasant, rosy face. As the prosecution hoped, his testimony, which closed out the day and resumed on Thursday morning, made for damning evidence against the defendant. Smith began by asking Smutzer what he knew about the bad blood between Ray and Bell.
"About the middle of February," said Smutzer, "Mrs. Ganesh wrote a letter to me and complained that Lanphier was annoying her in all sorts of ways, sticking his face in the windows at night, prowling around the house, and so on."
"What reply did you make to Mrs. Ganesh?" Smith asked.
"I wrote her that if he kept it up, to have him arrested."
"What did Mrs. Ganesh reply?"
"She wrote me another letter saying that she was afraid Lanphier would do her some harm, and that he was still bothering her."
"What steps did you take, Mr. Smutzer, in consequence of this second letter?"
Smutzer explained that he had immediately telephoned Ray's favorite watering hole, Smith's Saloon, and told the proprietor to send Lanphier around to me. When Lanphier showed up at the jail about an hour later, Smutzer told him to keep away from Mrs. Ganesh's house, or I'd have to arrest him.
When Ray protested that he had only gone there to fetch the tools he'd left behind when he was fired, Smutzer advised him to send the constable for them.
"And how," asked Smith, "did Ray react to that advice?"
"He shuffled away a few steps," Smutzer recalled, "and then turned to me with a queer look in his eyes and said, 'If I tell what I know of that woman, I can make it mighty hot for her.'"
According to Smutzer, Ray had informed him that Bell was presently consorting with a man named Helgeline who owned a gambling house in Aberdeen, South Dakota. A man was killed there and $10,000 was stolen. This man Helgeline fled with the money, and she has him there in that house.
Smutzer had investigated this charge by writing to Aberdeen, but dropped the matter after receiving a reply assuring him that Helgeline was a well-to-do farmer living near Mansfield, that he was of good repute and not wanted for any crime whatever.
Returning to the subject of Ray's conflict with Bell, Smith asked the sheriff what he knew of Lanphier being arrested at the insistence of Mrs. Ganesh. Smutzer's answer provoked an angry reaction from Wirt Warden.
"When Mrs. Ganesh and her hired man, Joseph Maxim, came to me to have Lanphier arrested," Smutzer said, "Maxim brought with him a bar of iron, a foot and a half long, which he said Lanphier had left on the place while prowling around the night before. I thought then, and I still think, that Lanphier intended to kill Mrs. Ganesh with that bar of—"
Worden, face flushed, was on his feet at once.
"Objection!" he cried. "This witness must be warned. He is trying to get matter into the record that he knows will be ruled out. He knows he must not offer his conclusions, but only the facts. He knows that conclusions are for the jury."
The objection was sustained, but, as in all such cases, the witness's words could not be unheard. When, after a largely fruitless cross-examination, a smiling Smutzer left the stand, observers agreed that his testimony had delivered exactly what the prosecution was aiming for, that it had been, as Harry Burr Darling would say, a clean strike for the state. Smutzer was followed to the stand by Leroy Marr, the deputy who had driven out to John Wheatbrook's farm to take Ray into custody. Even before he announced why he was there, said Marr, Ray had asked if Bell and her three children had made it out of the burning house. When Marr asked how he knew about the fire, Ray replied that he had been walking along by the house and saw smoke coming out of the windows and around the roof. Asked why he didn't yell, he could only offer the lame excuse that he didn't think it was any of my business. Marr then added a detail that, in a courtroom full of white-only faces, cast Ray's already dubious character in an even more unsavory light. After being taken to jail, Ray had been interviewed by State's Attorney Smith. In the course of their conversation, said Marr, Ray admitted that he had slept with Nigger Liz, but begged Smith not to put that in any statement. The testimony of Marr's colleague, Deputy William Antis, the next witness to take the stand, was particularly damaging to the defense. According to Antus, Ray not only admitted that he saw Mrs. Ganesse killing Helgeline, but stated that, were it not for his concern over hurting his mother, he would plead guilty to arson. As the correspondent for the Chicago Examiner put it, Antus's version of what Lanphier said amounted almost to a confession on the part of the prisoner. Following a brief cross by Wirt Warden, the witness was dismissed. The town clock was just striking 10 a.m. as he stepped from the stand. At that point, having fired its biggest guns with the testimony of the lawman, the state abruptly rested its case. 34. Scattershot. Believing that the prosecution's case wouldn't conclude until the end of the day, Wirt Warden was caught off guard by Smith's announcement and requested a recess until Monday morning. When Judge Richter denied the request, Warden had no choice but to proceed with his opening statement. Though delivered extemporaneously, his address, according to the rapturous account of Harry Burr Darling, was a model of lawyerly eloquence. He spoke slowly and with the utmost deliberation, Darling reported, and each word fell clearly on the ears of the entire courtroom. Several of the jurymen edged over to the front of their seats as if drawn toward the speaker like a needle attracted to a magnet. When he was finished, there was a profound quiet. Women sunk back in their chairs, and a peculiar light played over their faces. The spectators realized that Worden had made assertions in such a masterly manner that, if he proved able to back them up with witnesses, Ray Lamphere's neck was saved from the noose. Step by step, in his strong, sonorous voice, Worden set out the main points of his argument, all leading to a conclusion that would exonerate his client. That Mrs. Ganesse had plotted the fire, substituted a female body for her own, and was still alive. "Mrs. Ganesse was not burned in the fire of April 28th," Worden began. "We will show by evidence that the body of the adult female found in the ruins could not have been that of Mrs. Ganesse. We will produce as a witness John Ball, a local undertaker who knew Mrs. Ganesse very well. He will testify that the adult female body could not have been that of Mrs. Ganesse. We will produce a witness who saw her with a middle-aged man driving past her old home in a top buggy on the afternoon of July 9th, Warden continued. The two daughters of this witness also saw Mrs. Ganesse that day. We will show that Mrs. Ganesse had a motive for setting fire to her house. We will show that the crisis in her life came on April 27th, that she was in constant dread that Asla Helgeline, brother of one of her victims, Andrew Helgeline, might arrive in La Porte any minute and begin an inquiry which would reveal the fate of his brother, buried in the Ganesse Cemetery. Our evidence will show that on the afternoon before the fire, Mrs. Ganesse went to Minch's grocery store and bought an unusual quantity of kerosene, more than she was in the habit of buying. We will prove by testimony that on the afternoon of April 27th, Mrs. Ganesse had a conversation in front of the First National Bank building with a certain man, in which she said, 'It must be done tonight, and you must do it.' That night the house burned to the ground and the bodies of the three Ganesse children were found in the ruins. Our evidence will further show that on the Saturday preceding the fire, she was seen driving out to her house with another woman, slightly smaller than herself, who has never been seen since, unless it was her body that was found in the ruins of the fire. We will show that the teeth found in the ruins could not have withstood the terrific heat of the fire without crumbling to pieces. Consequently, the teeth found in the ruins must either have been thrown there, or else the fire could not have been as hot as it is generally supposed to have been. This being the case, the skull of the female could not have been burned away. We will further show that the bridge work made by Dr. Norton for Belle Ganesse could have been removed from the mouth in various ways. We will show by the testimony of local physicians that the three children came to their end by strychnia poisoning rather than burning. We will show that the bodies showed all the symptoms of strychnia poisoning rather than those of suffocation. We will show from testimony already introduced that it would have been impossible for Ray Lamphere to have gone there and administered poison.
Did Mrs. Gunness poison the children, place the adult body with them, remove her bridge work and leave it behind, and escape? If this be true, Lanphier cannot be guilty. On the strength of all this evidence, Worden concluded, we will show that Ray Lanphier is an innocent man and the object of untrue accusations.
The defense pressed the trigger of its revolver this morning, enthused Darling, and the report will echo through Judge Richter's courtroom long after the Lanphier trial has passed into history. If Worden opened with a bang, however, he followed with a misfire. His first witness was John H. Ball, a pioneering figure in LaPorte, renowned as the first white boy born in the county. After years spent as a bricklayer, cattle drover, miner, and U.S. cavalryman, Ball had opened LaPorte's first funeral home, selling the business to Austin Cutler upon retirement. Following the fire at the Gunness farm, the 74-year-old Ball had been called in by Cutler to assist in the removal of the four bodies from the ruins. In his opening statement, Worden had promised the jury that he would summon Ball as a leading witness to testify that the adult female body could not have been that of Mrs. Gunness. When, however, Worden posed the key question to Ball, from your knowledge of dead bodies and your acquaintance with Mrs. Gunness, was that the body of Mrs. Gunness? Smith objected on the grounds that it called for a conclusion, that the question improperly asked Ball, a lay witness, to offer a legal opinion. The objection was sustained, and Ball excused. Worden fared somewhat better after the lunch break, calling the first of several dental experts, Dr. George Wasser, a prominent Cleveland dentist and graduate of Western Reserve University. Worden asked if, in his professional opinion, the crown work found in the ruins of the fire could have passed through the heat which destroyed the skull bones.
I do not think so, said Wasser.
In your opinion, Worden continued, displaying a fragment of tooth, was this piece of tooth ever covered by the crown in the other set of teeth?
If it did cover this tooth, Wasser replied, it was an awful misfit.
Another dental witness, W.S. Fisher, agreed that the teeth could not possibly have gone through the fire that destroyed the skull, as the porcelain was free of cracks such an intense heat would have caused. Shown a pair of excising forceps, Fisher also explained how they could be used in snipping live teeth from a person's head.
Worden closed out the day with a hodgepodge of witnesses. Mrs. George Wright, a neighbor of Bell's, testified that she had seen the blaze through her bathroom window just as her mantel clock was striking the hour of 3. 25 minutes before Ray Lanphier, according to his claim, left Liz Smith's house. Undertaker William C. Weir told of visiting the farm on the day of the fire and seeing a 5-gallon can in the cellar. The can was empty and the solder melted away. Joe Maxson, recalled to the stand, verified Weir's statement, testifying that on the evening before the fire, he placed the oil can in the hallway at the end of the stairway in the frame part of the house. After the fire, it was in the cellar. In a move that seemed to promise a dramatic revelation, but ended up amounting to nothing, Worden called his opponent, State's Attorney Smith, to the stand to question him about a mysterious trunk he had surreptitiously hauled away from the Gunness carriage shed the previous spring. When the trunk was brought into the courtroom and opened, however, it revealed neckties, books, and letters, none of which had any relation to the case. Reporting on Friday's developments, most newspapermen agreed that, following Worden's strong opening statement, the defense had gotten off to a scattershot start, that no groundwork was laid for its theory that Mrs. Gunness is alive, or, if dead, that she was poisoned and not burned to death in a fire. Locally, however, the biggest story of the day had nothing to do with the lawyers, the witnesses, or the defendant. It had to do with the spectators.
35. Cesspool.
Throughout the 19th and early 20th centuries, newspapermen covering highly publicized murder trials rarely failed to comment, generally in tongue-clucking tones, on the large number of women who flocked to these proceedings and often made up the majority of spectators.
That ordinary housewives and mothers should evince such eager interest in gruesome and salacious crimes seemed a shocking violation of every prevailing belief about the so-called gentler sex. The situation was no different at the Lamphere trial. Owing to the scandalous nature of the anticipated testimony, efforts had been made to limit attendance to men. Apart from the opening day, however, when no ladies were permitted inside, the women folk of LaPorte showed up at the trial in droves. Women elbowed into the courtroom by the hundreds and occupied all the seats inside the rail that were not used by members of the bar, noted one Chicago reporter on the trial's third day, while the correspondent for the Indianapolis News, writing a few days later, estimated that the number of women present has run as high as 400, many of them handsomely gowned and occupying front seats. This flagrant display of prurient fascination among the community's female population provoked the predictable outcry. Its source was the Reverend M. H. Gerard, who had recently assumed the pulpit of the First Christian Church. On Thursday evening, November 19th, Gerard veered off the subject of his midweek sermon, beginning of family and business life, to deliver a fiery harangue against the eager horde of women trial-goers. "I have been thoroughly disgusted with the way women have flocked into the courtroom in large numbers and at all hours, both morning and afternoon, to have poured into their ears all the filth connected with the trial now in progress in our city," he began, deliberately avoiding so much as a mention of the foul name that had brought such infamy to LaPorte. "It seems these women have camped out near the cesspool and mean to stay there until it is drained of its rot. It is bad enough to see many men there, but when I see the women sitting right up in front, as near to the filth as it is possible for them to get, I presume they are there out of fear that one of the rotten words or scenes might be missed if they were further back. When I see this thing, I am at a loss as how to adequately describe it," continued Gerard, his voice ringing with indignation. "It is a strange thing that women, under no compulsion whatever, are found in large numbers in every notorious trial everywhere, and the more dirty the trial, the more women will usually be found in attendance. What are we to say of such women? Of their modesty? Of their refinement? It is mild to say they are not of the genteel type." Curious about the type of people who would be drawn to such dirty, rotten stuff, Gerard, as he explained, had visited the courtroom one afternoon and also one morning, and was appalled at what he saw. One young woman was comfortably located near where all could be heard and seen, and gave evidence of her very great pleasure in being so fortunately situated. She was artistically squishing a big piece of gum, he said with full-throated contempt, her cheeks bulging out on both sides with the fat cud, and her head bobbing like a cow's. "Well," he concluded, "many other things could be said, but I have more pleasant things to say. I hope that all decent women will keep away and frown on those who do go. Let modest, refined, well-bred ladies keep away from the very appearance of evil." Printed in its entirety in Friday's local newspapers, Gerard's diatribe set off an uproar. Both Harry Burr Darling and Edward Molloy, editor of the Herald, were inundated with letters defending the targets of the pastor's attack. Typical was the letter from a writer identified in headlines only as a well-known LaPorte lady, who charged Gerard with desecrating his pulpit and his own profession by casting slurs upon the women of LaPorte. Having attended the Lamphere trial several times herself, the writer affirmed that she had seen the very nicest and most refined ladies of town there. Moreover, she had heard nothing said by anyone in the court proceedings which contained one-tenth part as many obscene words and low phrases as Gerard had claimed. Striking a self-assertive note, very much in keeping with feminist sentiments of the time, the writer insisted on a woman's right to be educated in the workings of the legal system. "This is not an age when women are kept underfoot and in ignorance. A mere desire to see justice done and to learn the ways of justice
should not be construed as a gratification of evil tastes. Stating that Gerard had done nothing but bring ridicule upon his own head with his intemperate remarks, she reminded him that, from the minister of the gospel, we naturally expect charity for all and malice toward none. She ended with a swipe at Gerard's newcomer status, declaring that, as a newcomer to town, a distinct outsider, it was not his place to denounce the genteel trial-going women, whose characters are far above reproach. Women weren't the only ones offended by Gerard's sermon. "Husband Takes Exception" also declared a headline in the Weekly Herald. Reprinted below is an outraged letter sent to the paper by an unidentified gentleman of the city. Echoing the author of the earlier letter, the writer maintained that, as a recent arrival in LaPorte, Reverend Gerard had little right to make such a sweeping condemnation. "The brother has not been a resident of this beautiful city long enough to be qualified to dictate the tastes and desires of the ladies of this community." He then launched into a lengthy lecture of his own, part blistering attack on the minister, part gallant defense of his wife, part ringing tribute to American womanhood. "My wife attended the Gnesp trial, as did large numbers of other women, and now up mobs the Reverend M.H. Gerard and says that she and all the others are virtually not modest, refined, or genteel. In short, not respectable ladies. He would lead people to believe that the gentler sex of LaPorte are a carnal-minded lot who like to revel in what he calls filth and rot. Talk about arrogance, presumption, and the old criticaster's trick of curving a contumelious lip. All that is a mild sort of stupidity compared with this. Since when was this man commissioned to sit in judgment on the question of our women's modesty, refinement, and gentility? I glory in the American girl's stability and spunk. We all should be proud that her noble attributes of mind and soul do not break like blown glass before the various little naughtinesses of everyday life. If so sensitive and fragile as that, they would have shattered long ago. And I submit to any knowing man or woman whether the racy and unseemly words unavoidably spoken at the Gnesp trial were really more vulgar, rotten, and suggestive than those that oft come from preachers' lips when discussing dancing, the white slave traffic, and kindred delicate topics. I consider that woman's curiosity, her desire to see and hear and learn, is as legitimate a part of her life as of a man's, and that if her refinement and modesty are of a genuine and sensible quality, they will withstand all necessary indelicacies of the rough world all about her. Mr. Gerard will come in contact with just as good a moral element attending the trial as he will meet anywhere, church not excepted. My wife went to that trial a good woman, and she came from there a good woman still. True virtue can be trusted anywhere. I am not afraid to trust my wife. Mr. Gerard is not qualified or commissioned to sit in judgment over her. Decrying the minister's lecture as scurrilous, ungentlemanly, and unspeakably offensive, the writer concluded by referring to Gerard's sneering description of the young gum-chewing woman seated up front. "I think," he wrote, giving full vent to his anger, "that the young lady was engaged in a much better business than the immoderate Mr. Gerard spitting out unholy and gratuitous insults on the character of our women, thereby dragging the pulpit down to a level with the scandal-mongering street." Not everyone offended by Gerard's finger-wagging sermon responded with an angry letter. One local writer, Molly Long, was moved to compose a humorous poem. This bit of light verse, published in the Weekly Herald, took the form of a letter from the author to her friend Bessie Short of Chicago. "We're having lively times just now, dear Bess, in old LaPorte, for that mysterious Gnesp case is going through the court. They found a jury for the case, most fit in every way, for what they thought about it all they really could not say. We don't know whether she's alive or whether she is dead, or whether, when she went away, she took along her head. But this we know, she left her teeth. They're mostly made of gold, and every time we go to court, we hear the story told. One preacher scolds us dreadfully who go. Perhaps he's right.
but where a preacher goes, 'twould seem that women surely might. And so I'll go again and see what curious things they do, to find out whether teeth will burn and come out good as new. And then, when I get home, dear Bess, I'll write it all to you.' Despite the mockery and disdain he incurred, Reverend Gerard refused to back down. In a follow-up talk at his church, he insisted that he had the greatest respect for the real women of the city, who were of the highest caliber. His previous remarks had been addressed strictly to a certain class of women who were drawn to the trial by morbid curiosity, the type who delight in the weird and sensational, and were flocking like sheep to the courtroom purely out of a desire for entertainment. Replying directly to the writer who had claimed her prerogative to learn the ways of justice by attending the trial, Gerard presented himself as a defender of female rights, even while asserting a thoroughly hidebound view of the proper role of women. "I certainly would not keep down the liberty of women," he declared. "But liberty does not mean license. I repeat my belief and say God made man and woman. He made the man the stronger and set him over a particular field. He gave woman a peculiar nature and set her in the home to be the presiding spirit there. Her powers are represented by gentleness, sympathy, purity, devotion to principle, and love. The same unnatural impulses that drove certain women to sensational trials like those of Mrs. Ganess and Harry Faw, killer of famed architect Stanford White, were responsible, he claimed, for the multitudinous divorce proceedings that were destroying the moral fabric of the nation. Gerard's hectoring appeared to have a discernible effect. On the afternoon of Saturday, November 22nd, one day after his original harangue was reprinted in the papers, more women than ever showed up at the trial. As the special correspondent for the Chicago Daily Journal noted, this was attributed in large part to Reverend M.H. Gerard's attack on those who previously were spectators in the courtroom. 36. Parade. To bolster its central arguments, that Mrs. Ganess was alive, that she had faked her own death, and that Lamphere was not her accomplice, the defense brought on a parade of witnesses over the next 2 days of the trial. Bell's neighbor, Daniel Hudson, repeated his widely publicized story of having seen her and a strange man walking in her orchard on July 9th, an account corroborated by his two young daughters, Evelina and Eldora. "I was on the road, returning from town with a hayrick, and I saw two people at the Ganess place," said Hudson. "Even from that distance I could recognize her plainly. I knew her shape, and I knew her lumbering walk. I never saw a woman walk like that. I started up my horses to try to get up the hill to the orchard before she could get away, but she saw me first, and she and the man ran to their buggy, clambered in, and raced straight to the main road. I was within 20 feet of her, and could plainly see her face." Under cross-examination, Hudson was compelled to admit that the woman had been wearing a wide-rimmed hat with a double veil, one white, one black, that came down to her chin. How he could plainly see her face under those circumstances was an interesting question. Hudson stubbornly insisted, however, that he knew Mrs. Ganess well enough that he could not be mistaken. The testimony of another of Bell's neighbors, John Anderson, was offered to advance the theory that the headless body found in the ruins was that of a different heavyset woman, lured to the farm to be slain by and substituted for the murderess. On the Saturday evening before the fire, Anderson recalled, he was tending to his flower garden when Mrs. Ganess drove by in her buggy and stopped to chat with him. Seated beside her was a strange woman. She was a large woman, said Anderson, if not quite so large as Mrs. Ganess. Did you ever see her again? Asked Warden. Anderson gave an emphatic shake of his head. Never, he said. To support his contention that Bell had a partner in her murder business, someone other than Lamphere, Warden summoned Fred Rittman, described in the papers as a surprise witness. A former farmhand of Bell's, previously unheard of in all the months since the fire, Rittman told of a strange afternoon when, so Warden wanted the jury to believe,
Bell's co-conspirator had driven a victim to the death homestead, where he would be drugged, killed, and planted in a freshly dug grave. 2 years earlier, said Rittman, he was plowing in the cornfield when Mrs. Ganess hitched up her favorite horse and said she was going to drive to town. Before departing, she told me to inform any visitors that she would return shortly and to make themselves right at home. Shortly after, Rittman continued, a big green automobile whizzed up the driveway, and a couple of men, one elderly and the other medium but not so heavy set, got out. I exchanged greetings and asked what they wanted. They said they must see Belle Ganess at once. I explained that she was not at home but asked them to step inside and take things easy. I went back to my plowing and had been working about an hour when Mrs. Ganess came back. She put up her rig and came at once to me. "I want you to dig a hole for me," she said. "What kind of a hole?" I asked. "Just a hole for a brick foundation," she said. "The masons will be here tomorrow." She showed me where to dig and put stakes to mark the corners. "Dig it 5.5 feet deep," she said. "It did not occur to me at the time," said Rittman, "that it was about the size of a grave." Rittman went on to relate that, before quitting for the day, he had gone up to the house to get paid, and found Bell and the two men seated in the kitchen with several bottles of wine on the table. He himself had been offered half a glass, which left him feeling so queerly that he was certain the wine had been doped. The testimony of Mrs. Louise Gackle, a young skirt factory worker who lived on Park Avenue, the direct road from LaPorte to the Ganess farm, was meant to persuade the jury that Bell had escaped the burning house in the company of an accomplice after setting it ablaze. In the early morning hours of April 28th, said Mrs. Gackle, she awoke to drink a glass of medicine, having been unwell for the past few days. She saw by the clock on her bedside table that it was 3 in the morning. Just then she noticed a red glow, as of a fire, and went to the window. I saw that it was coming from the Ganess farm. As she looked outside, a red automobile with a canvas top came speeding down the road from that direction. Later that morning, as other witnesses attested, the same auto, or one of the same description, was seen going through the town of Hobart and also through Valparaiso. Joe Maxson was recalled to the stand to offer testimony that, if believed by the jury, would deal a serious blow to the prosecution. The handyman stated that, on the morning of May 19th, he was standing beside Lewis Schultz when the miner suddenly cried out, "I found the teeth!" According to Maxson, however, whose account was corroborated by his brother-in-law, Isaiah Aldifer, the miner did not remove the bridgework from the ashes he was sluicing, but from his vest pocket. He then stowed the teeth in his pocket again. It was near noon when Smutzer appeared. The sluice man pulled out the teeth and gave it to him. The person best qualified to rebut this testimony was, of course, Schultz himself. But old Klondike was nowhere to be found. A few other witnesses were called on Monday. Dr. Beau Bowell, who testified that, in his professional opinion, the crownwork exhibited could not have gone through the fire of April 28th. W. H. Ludwig, a former crematory attendant, who declared that 2 or 3 hours were necessary to consume a human body in a heat of 3,000 degrees intensity, and that the skull was the last to burn. County Commissioner William P. Miller, who told of finding a flat stone in the Ganess basement, he lifted it and saw a hole that looked as if a human skull had been concealed there. The skull was gone. The defense had one last, critically important witness to call. Dr. Walter S. Haynes of Rush Medical College. When, just before lunch recess on Monday, Warden announced that Haynes would not be able to travel to LaPorte until the following day, Judge Richter declared a recess until Tuesday afternoon, when the jury would hear the final testimony of the trial. 37. The Chemist. Though he lived to be 72, a ripe old age at a time when the life expectancy for an American male was 49, Walter Stanley Haynes was a semi-invalid for much of his adulthood, being afflicted with a debilitating respiratory condition. Despite this handicap, he managed to lead a remarkably active life. Born in 1850, the son of John C. Haynes, twice elected mayor of Chicago during Walter's boyhood, He attended the Massachusetts Institute of Technology before training as a physician at the Chicago Medical College. In 1874, he joined the faculty of Rush Medical College as a professor of chemistry and remained there for 50 years, a revered figure to generations of graduates. By 1884, Haynes was a figure of such renown that he became an early celebrity pitchman, touting the virtues of a popular brand of baking powder in newspaper ads. "I have recently examined a package of royal baking powder and have found it entirely free from adulteration and injurious substances of all kinds," read one such testimonial, an endorsement that speaks volumes about the concerns of consumers in the days before the creation of the FDA. 10 years later, Haynes was still promoting the baking powder in a newspaper ad that read, "I find the royal baking powder superior to all others in every respect. It is the purest and strongest. Walter S. Haynes, M.D., Consulting Chemist, Chicago Board of Health." Owing to his expertise as a toxicologist, Haynes became a leading figure in the still nascent field of forensic science. Along with a pair of eminent collaborators, he edited the two-volume Textbook of Legal Medicine and Toxicology, a pioneering work covering such subjects as gunshot wounds, mental perversions of the sexual instincts, and, in one chapter singled out for particular praise by reviewers in professional journals, the destruction and attempted destruction of the human body by fire and chemicals. In the course of his long and distinguished career, he was involved in a string of sensational murder cases, testifying at the trials of Adolf Lutgert, the Chicago sausage maker charged with murdering his wife and dissolving her corpse in one of the vats used to make his product, Thomas Neal Cream, the serial poisoner, whose last words on the gallows were, "I am Jack the..." and Dr. Bennett Clark Hyde, accused of dispatching millionaire Thomas H. Swope with strychnine. There was no secret about the testimony Haynes was expected to offer when he took the stand on Tuesday. Days before he arrived in La Porte from Washington, D.C., where he had been engaged in official business related to his work on the Revision Committee of the United States Pharmacopoeia, newspapers were reporting that he would tell of finding poison in the bodies taken from the ruins. After listening to the distinguished toxicologist, the jury would naturally conclude that Bell, fearing imminent discovery, had killed her children and committed suicide, and Ray would be acquitted of murder. Or so Worden and his co-counsel hoped. On the stand, which he occupied for just over 30 minutes, Haynes explained that, on May 27th, he had received several sealed jars from Coroner Mack, one containing the stomachs of Bell and two of her children. Cracking open the jar, he discovered that the organs were so badly decomposed that they had run together so that the material was like thick mud. A few fibers from the original wall were observable. The only possible analysis was by using the mass together. He blended the fetid sludge to obtain uniformity and removed one-third of it for examination. "I found an abundance of arsenic and a quantity of strychnine," said Haynes. "There was enough strychnine to have caused the death of 3 persons. Apart from one qualifying observation, that it was impossible to tell whether the poison was in 1, 2, or all of the stomachs, Haynes's testimony was everything that Worden could have hoped for. Then came the cross-examination. Asked if he could state with certainty that the 3 persons whose stomachs he analyzed had died of strychnine poisoning, Haynes replied that he could not. "The poison found in the stomach after death," he explained, "is not usually the poison which has caused death, for that has been absorbed and has gone to the remote arteries of the body. Indeed," Haynes added, "owing to the condition of the viscera submitted to him, he could not possibly determine the cause of death at all." Noting that for 10 days, the bodies lay at the morgue and were viewed by several hundred persons, Smith wondered if the strychnine may have been injected into the stomachs during that time. "Yes," Haynes conceded, "the poison might just as easily have been introduced after death." Haynes was followed to the stand by La Porte undertaker Austin Cutler, called by the state as a rebuttal witness. In the view of the correspondent for the Chicago Examiner, Cutler's testimony added a touch of farce comedy to the proceedings. To Ray Lamphere's defense team, however, there was nothing amusing about it. No sooner had the mortician been sworn in than Prosecutor Smith asked if he had treated the remains with any poisonous substances.
"Why, yes, I put poison on those bodies. I thought it was strange you never asked me before," Cutler said. "I scattered about 2 gallons of formaldehyde embalming fluid and 15